Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for coming and welcome to the University of Minnesota Bookstores. Before we begin, I would just like to invite you to come to our website where you can see a list of upcoming author events and where you can also access podcasts of all of the author events that we record. They're available about a week after the event. Our special guest today, as you know, is Jonathan Friesen. He lives in northern Minnesota on a small farm with his wife and three children, and as he says, a growing number of animals. When he's not traveling and teaching or hanging out with his family, Jonathan's passion is coaching gifted young writers in the art of fiction. His personal experiences with Tourette's syndrome inspired him to write this novel. We'd like to congratulate him on his contract with Penguin Books, and we're very pleased to have him with us today. Please welcome Jonathan Friesen.
Thank you. It's nice being able to talk to you a little bit beforehand. I'm glad you're all here. I don't know how old I was. I think I might have been 10. That could be off by quite a bit because my memory is quite poor when I get back beyond, 15 years old. But this is the memory. Going down to Nebraska, and I was at an auction with my grandfather. I know my folks were there too, but what I remember is sitting by my grandpa. It was in Nebraska. Yeah, I said that. And this is one of those auctions where, of course, the person speaks, hey, one of those quick talking auctions, and they pointed to everybody. One of the things I liked watching was how everybody bid on what was being auctioned. They didn't bid big. They bid very small. They bid with little movements of their face or little movements of their hand. They were small bidders. And the guy would point to them. They had just bid on the item that was being auctioned off. Yeah, they were small bidders. But what they were bidding on wasn't small. What they were bidding on were very huge items. They were bidding on beautiful woodwork things. They were bidding on farm machinery. Very expensive things. And what I do remember them bidding on that day is a combine. This combine, I don't know how much it was bid for, because I couldn't understand. I didn't know how much it was going for. The guy who was talking was speaking so quickly I couldn't even follow. I thought I heard 80,000, or was it? I don't know what it was, but it was just ridiculous amounts of money. And all I remember were among these small bidders getting very excited at the voice of this guy, because I had Tourette. And when excitement level goes up, well, especially when I was younger, so did my body movement level. It started to move. I was with it. I was with this guy. He was talking fast, and I was jiggling fast, and we were having a good old time. And that was with my grandpa. But I was at an auction with small bidders. And so probably the worst place to put someone with Tourette syndrome is at an auction. And I remember having his hand fire toward me. And I don't know if I truly bid on this combine. I don't know. But I remember for a moment thinking, I have just purchased an $80,000 combine. Because I remember the hand firing in my direction and thinking, there's no one else raising their hand. I'm going to spend $80,000 and my allowance is not that big. I got paid in nickels, not thousands. And I remember thinking then, next, I bet my grandpa is so ashamed of me. I bet he is so ashamed because he's going to have to foot this bill. And that was one of my first memories with Tourette. And it wasn't a happy one. Wasn't a happy one. Thinking about how it has affected and how it did affect my family. That's my auction with Grandpa story that almost made it into this book with the main character. In fact, it was in the book, and it got removed about, oh, I don't know, it got removed by about the third go-around with the editor. But it was the only story, it's the only personal, true story of mine that makes it into the life of Sam Carrier, who is the lead character in the book, The Auction with Grandpa. Introduce myself a little bit. My name is Jonathan Friesen, as you heard. I've lived here in the cities my whole life. New Hope was where I grew up, and presently now I moved out of the cities into more north of Mora, so I have a little bit of room for my three kids and Wendy, my wife, to run around, which is good. It's good to have them run around. The kids, that is, not my wife. It's good to have the kids run around. And growing up, I think I was a good writer. I say I think I was. I'm not positive on that. I think writing was always going to be something that I did. But everybody thinks stuff like that. Everybody has little skills like that. And besides, I had Tourette syndrome, which made it very hard to write. It wasn't an easy deal. Writing was two words forward, and then kind of one scribbled back, and then two forward and a jerk, and then so one scribbled back. I look at the very young stuff I wrote before I was, oh, 6 or 7. It's very beautiful, but after that, it gets pretty scribbly pretty fast. It was hard. Writing was hard. It was physically hard. It almost hurt to write going through school. My hand, I almost had to force it to do what I wanted it to do. And that's part of what Tourette syndrome is. So I've lived with Tourette syndrome since I was about, I'm going to say 6, although even that date is unclear. I wasn't diagnosed until I was 19. And when it was 19, finally, my brother, who has been was doing a lot of research on this, said, "Hey, Tourette syndrome." And it was kind of the first time I really connected with that and pursued it. And yeah, sure enough, I had Tourette syndrome. And it was wonderful to hear a word put on it. I finally had something I understood. It wasn't just this thing that made me do weird things. It was a thing I understood. Something that made sense, even though it doesn't make a lot of sense at the time. I'm going to read to you a little bit from this, two snippets from this book. Jerk California is the latest novel I wrote, kind of borrowing nothing of my life as far as actual events, except for that one story I just told you that got removed. So that's not in here. But all the emotion of it. So I would think back, what did it feel like? And that was hard to do for me. I didn't want to do that. That was painful to go back there and think about that. What did it feel like to try to ask a girl out when your face is going, arr, arr, arr. What does that feel like? It's tough. What does it feel like to try to make it on the team when everyone on the team is staring at you because your arms are jerking all over the place? That's tough. And going back there is not a place I wanted to visit. Somehow, when you get older and you get to be an adult, I guess we're kinder. We just don't ask anymore. And that's kind of the cycle of it. You're young and you're in elementary school, and you know what? In elementary school, almost everybody is kind of strange. The kid beside you is picking his nose, and the other one on the other side of you is doing some other, goofy stuff, crawling under the desk, and you're jerking around. So, we're all kind of just different. That's elementary school. But then comes middle school. And then it's not so okay to be different anymore. And then all of a sudden in middle school, we start to get involved in the girl and the boy stuff. And then it all of a sudden matters that we're different. And then comes high school, and by then you're pegged. You're in your place. And it's very hard to change that. That's kind of the cycle of it, for me at least. And I sure don't claim to talk for everybody. But I'm going to read you the first chapter of my book, Jerk California, about a young man named Sam. And the first chapter takes place the moment of his diagnosis. But it doesn't stay there. Then it skips forward into his life when he's about 19, where it stays for the rest of the book. Chapter 1. Sam has it. Question is, how bad? The pediatrician smiled, like he got off on destroying a kid's life. Like children frequently went to sleep normal and woke up monsters who couldn't keep their damn bodies still. He stared at me, waiting. My right hand twitched. He pointed and continued. The disorder has seasons. One day he'll flail like a windmill in spring, then the wind will die down. You won't see anything for months. He turned to my mom. Now, there are some experimental drugs. Who the hell is supposed to pay for those? My stepdad said. The doctor rose. I can see you need some time, Bill. He shook my 6-year-old hand, gave my stepdad a pat on the back, and slipped out of the examining room, leaving the three of us to stare at my jerking hands and shoulders. What did he say, Mom? Bill, when's it going to go away? Bill stood and paced the room. Go away? Your twitches won't ever stop. He cursed and kicked the doctor's swivel chair. I stared at Mom. Never? Not even when I'm older? Mom scooted her chair in front of mine. He says you have Tourette's. I mouthed the word, and she leaned forward and stroked my arms, gentle at first, then harder and harder and mixed with tears. I knew she was trying to rub that bad word out of me. What does that mean? I asked. It means, Bill said, you can forget about ever running my machines. My hands squeezed the jacket Bill gave me, the green one, with Tarboy on the front and a cement mixer on the back. I pulled free of Mom and grabbed Bill's pant leg. I can stop it. Please, Bill, I started to cry. I'll be still. Promise. Old Bill turned his back. Mom closed her eyes. And even at 6 years old, I knew I was alone. That's Sam's experience. Discovering, for him, getting a name on it. A name on it when he was much younger. And without the people around him, not the support, a very hard thing. He grows up in a small town. A little bit about this book, a little bit about Sam's experience. Again, none of it's mine. All of it is, the emotion of me is in that. And Sam has lost his father. He loses his father when he's 2. And Tourette being a very inherited disease, it's passed down from person to person, from father to son or mother to son or whatever the case is. His came through his father, who's now dead. And he has no place to put all that anger, so it's all pent up. He thinks his main problem is Tourette. It's not Tourette. His main problem is his anger and where he doesn't know how to put it. And so through his life in a small town, he goes through the stages of elementary school, where he is, all kids are weird. But then as he gets older, he goes through the stages of being pegged and mocked, made fun of, teased. And finally, accepted as being the strange kid that nobody wants to be around. Except his saving grace is a old man named George. George the Coot, I named him. George the Coot is a gardener. And Sam takes a internship with George. Falls in love with this guy. The first guy has paid some good attention to him. Finally, he has found someone who doesn't seem to look at those twitches as being a horrible thing. Just kind of, hey, you're you. He doesn't know that the man is his father's best friend, was his father's best friend. And through a series of events, George sends him on a road trip from Minnesota, where the book takes place, to California. And it's on this road trip that he discovers himself. That's where the dirt California comes from, the title of the book. In the places that he stays, the people he stays with, all of a sudden he is accepted. And for the first time feels something he's never felt before. And yes, he falls in love on the way. The girl he's always wanted to go, he's always wished he could ask out. He's always imagined himself being with, but of course he couldn't. Goes with him on this trip. And I won't spoil why for you. But it's a neat story of his kind of redemption, his coming around full circle, and it's a hopeful story. It's a story of hope. Because by the end, he's not the same guy as he was at the beginning. So, the story of Dirk California. All through this, and I'm not going to talk too much longer, if you have any questions, I really want you to feel free in asking them, because this is kind of our time. I'm here for a little while. I'll do some signing when I'm done. But, if you have some questions about any aspect of life, mine or his, feel free to ask. I'm going to read one more piece of this, and this is on their journey. Things I need to set up for you in this little snip. Now he's 19, and Naomi is the girl he's always dreamt of. He's always dreamt of having for his own. She looks perfect on the outside. Everything about her is perfect. You know, for him, he's the nothing on the outside is perfect, and she's the everything. And another character you'll meet here is Dirk. Dirk is from a Nebraska farm he stays at. Dirk is also perfect. He's a Nebraska Cornhusker tight end who has fallen as they've stayed at Dirk's home. He has completely fallen for this Naomi. And Dirk and Sam have been in this competition trying to prove their worth for Naomi. Dirk being this big, husky, perfect, handsome guy. And Sam being twitchy Sam, thinking he has nothing going. And now Sam and Naomi are about to move on to the next stage of their journey. So they're leaving. I think that'll be enough to set it up. Light rain falls as Naomi and I carry our bags toward the barn. We leave Don and Kate, arms around each other, standing on the porch. Lizbeth and Mary stomp through the farmyard muck. Dirk rocks on the porch swing with arms crossed, his eyes slits. Naomi declined his offer to carry her bags. I said he could carry mine, but patient, perfect Mennonites must have their limits. So where's the truck? Naomi asks. There's been a change. I open the barn door. Do you like orange? She gasps and furrows her brow and turns with a grin. I load our things into the back seat. Let's see if she sounds as good as she looks. The Chevy roars. I know engines, and judging by the sound, this one's been itching for an adventure. I feather the accelerator and the car darts forward into the yard. I let it idle and walk with Naomi back to the porch. And with each step, I feel lonelier. I take a last look at the truck parked in the barn. It's a great trade. My brain knows it. But my chest is tight. It's like losing George all over again. The family gathers around us. Now, it's traditional to bless all those who stay here, Don says. You mind? Naomi squirms, and I twitch, taking that as a green light. Dear Father, Big Don prays along, but it's different from when the TV preachers pray. I know Don thinks someone's actually paying attention. You two take care. Kate hugs us and pecks our cheeks. Don follows with a bear hug of his own. You know, you're a lot like your dad, Don says. I know, twitching and all. He looks sharp into my eyes and softens his gaze. No, gentle James lives on in gentle Jack. Before I can respond, the girls run up and cling to Naomi. You coming back? Elizabeth asks. I don't know. Naomi wipes her shirt. Depends on Sam. Dirk strides up to me, extends his hand, and squeezes. Hard. Drive safe. He moves to Naomi. Hurt, puppy eyes look strange in a tight end's body. He starts to speak. Peeks at me and suddenly lunges towards Naomi. It's a half-hug, half-tackle, and I'm surely going down. But Dirk regains his footing. Come on back any time. Another quick glance at me, and he reaches into his pocket. He pulls out a note, stuffs it into her hand. For me? Thanks. Naomi turns. Hang on to this, will you, for me? Hang on to this, will you, Sam? I don't have any pockets. I don't want to lose it. Oh, there's agony in Dirk's eyes as he follows that paper into my hand. Don covers his face with his big paw, but can't hide the chuckle that works his body. Kate sighs. Now, if you two are going to make Kansas by nightfall, you better get moving. Give our best to Turk and Trish. And we hop in and give the glass a flutter. Gas the flutter. Don reaches his hand into the car. South on 81 until 150. Brings you right into Hillsboro. Kansas has weather, so drive careful. Thanks for everything. I take my hands off the wheel, for letting us stay, and for the car. Do I owe you anything? Well, most people would leave a gift. Without hesitation, Naomi hops out of the car, jogs up to Big Don, and kisses his rain-soaked cheek. The big guy flushes. She turns to Stu and freezes the poor teen. Naomi finally reaches Dirk, stops inches in front of him. Dirk's eyes grow. He shifts on his feet, brushes his hair back, wipes his brow, and passes out, falls like a log into the mud. The family kneels around him. Kate looks up. That'll do, Naomi. Could I see my letter? Naomi reaches out her hand, but I'm driving and pretend not to see it. She hits my shoulder. I dig in my pocket for the note. My fingers wrap around it, and I want to throw it out the window into the storm, but my arm obeys her instead of me. She has it, reads it, and wears a big smile. What does it say? She glances at me and back down toward the sheet. It's my letter. Minutes later, she reads it again. I stretch back, peek over, and try to catch a few sentences. Sam, she folds the paper and scolds me with her look. Here, would you mind holding on to it? I grab the note and squirm it into my front pocket. It's not fair to be this close if I can't see it. Naomi's not fair. Were you going to kiss him? I ask. Yeah, there a problem with that? I turn the windshield wiper to high. Well, a kiss is... Well, doesn't a kiss mean... I twitch hard. Is there anybody you wouldn't kiss? She whips her body toward me. And what do you mean by that? Well, nothing. Oh, no. You said it. What do you mean? My body jumps. Left shoulder, right shoulder, fingers stretch, face muscles stretch. What was I saying? Rain sheets across the glass, and I peer ahead. Oh, hell. When you kissed me during the snowstorm, didn't it mean anything to you? I puff out steam and wait for her rage. But her body softens, and she sweeps the hair off her face. No. No! My hand twitches so hard we swerve into the chopped shoulder. I veer back onto the road. No? Nothing? My voice raises over the thunder. You changed my life and don't give it a thought? Well, I did. Plenty. I wipe sweaty hair from my eyes. I thought about that kiss day and night for months. Months, so no more casual, oh, what the hell, I'll kiss Sam stuff. Take your charity affection somewhere else. Find a different monster to kiss. I'm suddenly exhausted, and my muscles still, and the pounding rain has any energy left. I peek at what I've done. Naomi stares straight ahead, unreadable. It's just that, I say, it mattered to me, is all. I wouldn't kiss a monster. Hours of tortuous silence had passed since I spoke. You asked if there was anyone I wouldn't kiss. Naomi pauses. I don't think I'd kiss a monster. I shoot a glance in time to catch a slow exhale. Well, on second thought, she says, I have. Her words pierce. She's never mocked me or ripped my threats before. Finally, the cruel truth. I take a deep breath. At least I know where I stand. A monster. I get it, I say. She slowly turns her head as I make the left onto 150. She looks confused. Ahead, skies lighten behind the Hillsboro sign. Yep, good to know where I stand. Being a creature sucks, but at least she finally said it. So it's a Beauty and the Beast type of relationship. At least I didn't lose my bride to Dirk. I can't go getting fantasy and reality mixed up. Look at her, Sam. I do, and my mouth flops open, and I can't stop my blurt. You're beautiful. The car swerves. I'm sorry, stuff pops out. Naomi lays her head against the window. Beautiful, huh? I slow as we enter Hillsboro. The town appears from nowhere, grows right up from the surrounding fields. A water tower, grain elevator, only tall stuff there is. Small sign reads, Welcome to Hillsboro, home of Tabor College. Great. More college guys. If Naomi's still in this car when we pull out of here, I'll call this stop a success. Two nights in lovely Hillsboro coming right up. I drive to the Rambler on A Street and stop. Sam, Naomi's eyes plead, save time for a walk tonight. We need to talk. I chose that little piece because one of the aspects of Tourette that was hardest for me was figuring out what people really meant, especially in guy-gal relationship stuff. I was always missing, always confused. I never could figure things out. Because in my mind, I couldn't believe that someone could see me through the me on the outside. And so everything I thought of, I kind of took through that grid. Sam's has some of the same issues. He can't believe that he can actually be seen, liked, for just who Sam is. And so he and Naomi have these little interchanges all the way through where they just miss. And I think the relationship piece is one of the hardest things for someone with Tourette because, you know, Tourette isn't like, it's not like cancer. You don't die from Tourette. It's not like Alzheimer's. You don't lose your mental faculties from Tourette. So it's not, in those senses, it's not damaging. But as far as the relationship piece, it's kind of a killer. It can be kind of a killer. That is one. That's basically what I have to share with you today. If you have any questions, I wanted to do a little bit of time just to. I have this big mic, and I might be able to answer what you ask. I might not, but I'm sure willing to give it a shot. Yeah. Mowing the lawn. I'd written two books about things that I had an agent who I think saw a fair amount of potential in what I write, and I wrote two books, but neither of them were from my heart. And I finally decided I'm making this too hard. I want to write about something that's from my heart. Something that is an emotional book. I wanted it to be real. So I wrote something that I think, if it's nothing else, it's very real. I know this guy. It's how it is. It's how it was, for me at least. I can't say it's how it is across the board. And I was mowing the lawn, and by the time I started mowing the backyard, and I thought, well, why don't you just write something you know? And by the time I finished mowing, I had the story. And then I ran in and quickly wrote it down as fast as I could and started writing on it the next morning. So, came fast. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
Why did you take George away?
Oh, I don't know if he took him. He leaves about midsection. I think for him, he's. Well, I wanted Sam to make his discoveries, and I wanted him to become who he needs to become on his own. And though George is the impetus to get him to start to make his changes, I didn't want George to be there holding his hand. I wanted Sam, who's also named Jack. I should have explained that. Sam and Jack, they have the same, they're essentially the same person. That's a big part of the book. But I wanted Sam to have to make those changes in himself. I've read a lot of books in which the someone else makes the change for your character. Someone else comes along, saves the character, takes them by the hand, and everything's good. But that's just not how it was for me. And it's not how it was, I think, for a lot of people, how it is for them. At some point, people let go of your hand and they point you in a direction, and then you have a choice. And I wanted the story to be all Sam's choice. And I want it to always be a question mark. Is he gonna stop? Is he gonna turn around? Is he gonna quit this journey? And if you know he's not gonna finish it, he's gonna never realize the lessons he needs to get. So I think that's why I took him away pretty quick. Yeah. Yeah. The first two. Yeah, the first six chapters took 2 years to write. I wrote them 30 times. And that's not an exact number. It might have been 34, it might have been 32, but approximately 30 times. The rest of the book took 4 months, all of it. The other 28 chapters or so. And so that first, because unless I feel like I'm off to a really nice start, and I'm in love with what I'm doing, it's really hard for me to keep the momentum and the impetus going. So I need to feel like I have something precious here. And so I had to keep rewriting that first part till it felt precious to me and right to me emotionally, and then we can cruise on with the rest. And then, yeah, of course, there's going back. I think the other sections I rewrote probably five times. So it was a total rewrite of about five different rewrites. Yeah. You make him heroic. Every character, I don't care who it is, every character has to be. We don't stick with characters who aren't heroes in some sense. Doesn't have to be a big sense. It doesn't have to be a huge deal. In the very beginning of the book, you'll see Sam, and this is the first cha second chapter, Sam coming to the rescue, if you will, of Naomi, and that rescue, I think, says to the reader, this character's worth sticking around with. I know he looks like a loser right now. I know he has nothing going. I know he doesn't look like he has any friends. But did you see that? Did you see what he just did? There's hope inside. There's some chance. This character's going to be okay. Stick with him. It's going to turn around. And you have to plant that seed really early, because then your reader says, "Okay, this character's worth sticking around. I'll invest. I'll invest $9 and an evening with this character, if they believe your character really has something that they can turn around." But unless you put that there, then it becomes, yeah, just kind of a slogging through one issue after the other, and the reader is, oh, come on, do something positive, be somebody, do something. So I think it's really important, if you, whatever the disadvantage is, to show that the character is somebody more than is seen with the disadvantage really quickly. Then readers will stick with you and they'll love it. Yeah. Oh, sure. Oh, sure. I had a readers a readers group. We hung out, and they ripped it apart and put it together, or at least they ripped apart parts they thought should be ripped apart, and sometimes I agreed with them, often I didn't. But yeah, it's all good feedback. You know, if everybody said the same thing, I kind of got the idea, okay, maybe it's right. But I also have an opposite idea. Too many people reading it is also detrimental. The first two that I wrote that didn't go anywhere, I had a lot of people read it, and I had so much feedback, you don't know what to do with it all. What do you do with all this? You find the people who are trustworthy guides in your life and say, yeah, I'm sticking with these people. Good Lord. I went to a writer's conference. Real quick answer. I went to a writer's conference. I went there a day early by mistake. I walked into a dinner that was supposed to be for faculty only, but I thought it was for everybody. I thought everybody there was a like me, a peon, and I sat down by a woman, and not that that's in and of itself is a strange thing, except she was an agent. And we started talking, and it wasn't until halfway through the dinner I realized everybody there was either an established writer or an agent or an editor, and I was the only one who didn't belong there. And they just assumed that I was some agent or editor who they hadn't met yet. And I was Jonathan Friesen, and I introduced myself just like that. I didn't go on any further, but we got along so well just on a personal level, that halfway at the end of the dinner, I said, "Well, after being an agent today, I think I could, do pretty well here. Do you think, you might want to take a look at what I've written?" And she said, "Oh, absolutely." And it was kind of almost like a jokey thing, but we made an appointment, had a long talk, and then she turned me down. And she turned me down for a year. And then a year later, I got an email that said, "I'm ready. Send what send it." So, one of those little God put together things, because I don't know any other way to explain it. There's one other. There was a scene where he's so furious at Naomi because they keep on missing, and so there's this demolition. He's so angry that he's in this small town, and they're having frontier days, and so he goes to where all the demolition derby cars are lined up, and he just wants to smash something. And one of the groups there doesn't have a a driver. The driver didn't show up, and it happened to be that in this small town, every store sponsors a car, if that makes any sense to you, to ride in the demolition derby. And so, in this demolition derby, the one store that didn't have a driver was a bookstore, a Christian bookstore, and so on this Christian bookstore, they're above their on their placard, the sign on the placard, it was a picture of Jesus holding out his arms. So on the side of the car is a picture of Jesus holding out his arms, and he's hops into this car and is riding around, and no one else wants to smack into Jesus. So he gets all the way around, and he wins this thing because no one else wants to dent the good Lord. And so I thought it was just hilarious, and it's just perfect. But it was the booklet was getting too long. It's another one of the constraints of when you go with a publisher. They say, we want it 356 pages, and that's it, or whatever it is. And so that's a scene they wanted removed, even though for me it was very satisfying. Anyway, yeah, it's really a couple of them that were removed. Yeah. Yes, but I think the yeah. But you know, you have a story that I don't know you at all, but you have a story that only you can tell. Only you can. You know, no one else has that. No one else has your set of circumstances and your story. So that story is so unique to you that it's going to be from your heart. So that's the one I would tell. That's the one. I would not worry about what people say they need. You can find out very clear, easily, what publishers say they're looking for. They're looking for this. They're not looking for this. They want this. Or you can say, this is what I have. This is what I've been through in my life. This is the pains. These are the struggles. These are the sorrows. These are the happiness. This is the joy. This is what I've been given in my life. I can use this because no one else has this. And then you can write from your heart. I think whatever comes out there is probably the story you should be telling in some form. So it's really starting there. Whatever your passion is, and sticking with that. And because passion covers a multitude of sins. I mean, you can be a writer of average ability. I'm not saying you are. But if you write with heart and emotion, people pick up on that, and they'll say, you know what, I see in you what I need. You know, I see in you somebody I want to spend some time with. So I think writing with emotion is the biggest deal. And then obviously these days, unless you want to self-publish, which you can, 85% of books now are self-published. I didn't know that. That's a phenomenal number. 85% of books published last year are self-published, which means, you know, you don't necessarily need a publisher anymore. It's just, what kind of book do you have? This type of book would not sell well self-published. I would have to be in schools every single day, or I would have to be at colleges every single day doing discussion. What kind of thing I'm doing now? And I have a family. Some books, like, you know, how-to books, self-help books, you know, those books do great self-published. Other books probably don't. You know, and then you would need an agent. Just querying agents. Yeah. Well, if I didn't have it, I would have tried. I would have tried. Who knows if it would have worked?
Tired of reading this stuff, and it reached the ceiling. And they turned it on top, and then that was a manuscript. And he sat down and he said, "This is great stuff. Contact her. This is a book and a movie." So she got it right off the bat.
Well, that is definitely the way to go for all of us. Yeah. I guess I didn't. I think fiction, in some sense, has to be truer than a memoir. When you write fiction, it has to be believable. When you write a memoir, it really doesn't. Things happen in people's lives that are so crazy. You'd say, yeah, it has to be true. I mean, no one could have made that up. And it's absolutely bizarre. I wanted to write a story that just rang true for people of all ages. And so I guess I wanted to make it, I wanted to do it that way. Secondly, you know, I wanted to be able to take some liberties and have some fun with it. Have some fun with some emotion. I could write about my story, and some people would really dig that. Some people, but it would be a very small segment. probably people who are people who are interested in Tourette syndrome. And but by writing about a kid with a struggle who has Tourette, but you know what? His real issue isn't Tourette. And all of us have our stuff. And all of us have, on some level, have been lied to. We all have hidden things that we don't want to show. And so because you do it that way, then all of a sudden you open up your audience to everybody in the entire world. That's who we all are. And I guess I wanted a broader audience. Yeah.
Did you learn about something from Sam? Or do you have any expectations that
readers
want to learn about?
You know, I purposely didn't want it to be a preach, any book that would, you know, do a message. I wanted it just to follow the character's heart and be true to the character. So if he wanted to do this, and this might sound weird to you, Sam would speak to me. Literally, I'd be lying in bed, and if you're a writer, you understand it, but if you don't, then it'd be hard. I would actually, not like he'd say voices in my head, but I would lie awake, and I would be thinking about the next scene I'm going to write the next morning, and I'd say, no, he can't do that. He has to do this. And then I would think, oh, crud, if he does that, what am I going to do with my story? Because my story, I'm thinking he's going to do this. And so these little things are goofing around in your head. So actually, I'd totally forgotten your question, but that's whatever it was, that I hope that was an answer to your question. You know, no, there's only one other character, and that was my grandmother, there is a grandmother figure in the book, and the grandmother, I felt like I knew her well, but none of the other characters are actually other people, and so, you know, that's the whole deal. The story is through his eyes. He's clueless how other people see him, and so in the story, he's clueless how other people see him. And so it kind of works. I was writing it exactly how, in my mind, this guy who I knew well would picture and believe that person would be thinking of him and that person would be thinking of him. So it's written through his point of view. So no, I didn't have any specific people for the others. Anyway. Two more questions. Well, yeah. This particular book is a one-off, so there aren't. It's not a sequel situation. There will be no more, which is very hard for me to let go of this main character because I love him. I wanted to write two with him, but I wasn't able to. And but then it goes to the next book, where. The next book is very, very different in that the main character is an adrenaline junkie. He lives for the high of adrenaline and doesn't feel alive, doesn't feel normal unless he's just right on the edge of doing the craziest of life and death things. It's a firefighter story, a wildfire story out in California it takes place. And so that story is kind of, in a way, an opposite, but in a way not. He's also medicating himself. He's also has a distorted worldview, a distorted view of how others see him, I should say, is a better way to say it. We'll see. I don't know how that's going to work out. This one came so easily because there's so much of my own emotion in it. It's worth it. It's worth the $9. The next one, I'm looking forward to seeing how that comes out. I just don't know. I don't know how it's going. It's going to be a special book, but right now it's a harder book to write. like I said, most of this one came in 4 months. That one will, that's been a year already of just pounding my head on the microphone. Yeah, the title came when I was mowing. Jerk California. I said, how perfect. How perfect. And then the last question I'll take, did you? Yeah. That's a great one to finish up with, though. An immortal story? Well, I guess I would say when you're able to somehow capture something that you're able to capture an emotion or capture a situation that doesn't disappear with a generation, that one generation reads it and says, oh yeah, that is, I see myself there. And the next one does too. And the next one does too. Which is why just putting a lot of jargon in your stories almost disqualifies it from being the as an immortal story. You would like it to be read. Who knows? In 20 years, will it be in the library? Used books sales for 5 cents, or will it still be, you know, on the in the best time seller New York Best Times bestseller list? Who knows? I'm hoping for the second. I'm hoping I captured something that will last a long time. So, yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's it. Thank you so much for coming. You bet.